Courtney has started a SME accelerator in Kenya. She started back in 2010, is that correct? With just 7 companies, now working with 1,000 all SMEs. It's called Synapis, and there will be a video shown about it if you want to find out more. Also, Courtney started out as a teenager raising sheep and sold sheep, lambs. She sold lambs in high school and was able to put a down payment on her first car from what she made selling sheep. There is definitely an animal theme going on through this conference, isn't there? But it also proves that microagriculture can pay the bills. So well done, Courtney. I'm going to hand over to you.
Thank you so much. So my name is Courtney Mills, and I am originally from Texas, but I have lived in Nairobi for the past 7 years. I am a founder at Synapis, and I'm just so humbled to be able to share a story with you today. Thank you very much. So let's see if we can get this presentation up. Great. So my story starts in January of 2009, and I was stuck in a roundabout. Oops. Just like this. I don't know how many of you have been in a roundabout like this in Nairobi, but if you have, you know how I was feeling at that moment. I was completing research in Kenya on how to ease bottlenecks in the private sector as part of my master's thesis. And I was in downtown Nairobi when my cab shook pitifully and then crept to a halt. So while sitting in the sweltering heat as the cab was being fixed, I made a decision. I have to go buy my own car. So I talked to a wise Christian friend about where I should look, and he said, Courtney, the one piece of advice I can give to you about buying a car in Kenya is that if someone tells you he is a born-again Christian, do not buy your car from him. He is almost certainly a con artist. So I laughed at first, just like you guys, and I thought this is a funny joke to be repeated at a dinner party sometime. But the more I thought about it, the less funny it became. Because it meant that participants in the marketplace in Kenya had actually prostituted Jesus' name for economic gain to the extent that claiming to be a Christian was now equal, in fact, to being called a con artist. If this was true, it was a tragedy of epic proportions. And everywhere around me, I saw potential in Kenya. But the more time I spent there, the more I realized the extent of this problem. A country with more churches than Texas, and as a Texan, this is very hard to believe, has 85% of the population claiming to be followers of Jesus, and yet it is in the top 40 most corrupt countries in the world. How does that add up? I knew that there was economic poverty, right? As demonstrated by the endless sea of tin roofs in Kibera, this is one of Africa's largest slums. But there was a bigger and related poverty too. It was a poverty of leaders that would reflect Christ's light and lessons in the marketplace. Nearly all Kenyans know about Jesus, and in fact, most can quote scripture better than I probably ever will. But there is an integration issue. Because sometimes it feels like life on Sunday and life on Monday is as different as life on Mars and Venus. So I went back to Harvard, I finished my thesis, and I declared that I had found the most important bottleneck that would help alleviate economic poverty. Early stage entrepreneurs above the micro level. So while there was financial support for micro-entrepreneurs through MFIs and support for growth stage and corporate stage companies through investment funds and banks, there was just this real dearth of support for the many educated middle-class entrepreneurs that had innovative ideas and companies at the early stage. The solution then was to open up the bottleneck by providing support for early stage entrepreneurs to get more of them to the growth stage where existing support was available, thereby actually stimulating the entire private sector. But it was also at this time that I started to understand how to solve the second challenge, this challenge of Christ-like leadership. because I began to fully recognize the profound cultural influence of successful entrepreneurs globally, for good or for bad. People avidly read their biographies and they listen to their quotes. They use their companies to start political revolutions. And as we know, they even support them to run for president. The influence of successful entrepreneurs today is undeniable. And this is also true in countries like Kenya, and even at all levels of business. Even the entrepreneurs in Kibera that are the most successful with their micro businesses are also often the community leaders, the movers and shakers in their environment. So here's the real first lesson that I want you to remember. Entrepreneurs have the potential to solve both economic poverty as well as the poverty of Christ-like leadership, because they create jobs and economic wealth for their country through their ingenuity and perseverance, while also often becoming highly influential. And if, and only if, these entrepreneurs are Christ-like leaders themselves, they can lead their communities as good and sacrificial examples for those around them. Synapis was born with this mission. Our mission is to make disciples and alleviate poverty through the power of entrepreneurship. Synapis is the Latin word for the mustard seed. And just like our biblical namesake, our goal is to help entrepreneurs take seeds of ideas and grow them into God-glorifying enterprises. We do this by providing them with advanced business training that also teaches them how to integrate their faith with their business, paired with consulting, mentorship, and access to capital. To date, we have accelerated around 1,000 early-stage companies in our program and now also operate in Uganda, Ghana, and Brazil. And our vision is to empower 10,000 kingdom entrepreneurs around the world in every country where economic poverty and a poverty of Christ-like leadership exists. By doing so, we want to play a major role in taking back the marketplace for the kingdom of God. Although we are now starting to reach some more impressive numbers, our beginnings were a little more humble. After developing the concept for Synapis in grad school, I moved to Nairobi in August of 2010. And one of the first orders of business was to set up a legal nonprofit. So my co-founder, this amazing Kenyan I met at Harvard named Karibu, and I, we arrived and we submitted the paperwork. And then we waited. And we waited, and we waited. And finally, with our entrepreneurs starting the program in only a few weeks, we went to the NGO board to try to understand the delay. They could smell our desperation. Right? This was the moment they had been waiting for. And the friendly case officer said, "Hey, I'll just meet you guys." Sorry, guys, I think I'm going the wrong direction here. Let me see if I can get there. "I'm just going to meet you guys at this coffee shop across the street tomorrow morning." So I was like really hopeful, like, yeah, this is great. But Karibu looked super worried. And he told me I need to let him do most of the talking, and then the next morning he handed me a handheld recorder to put in my purse. So this friendly case officer wanted a minimum of $1,000 facilitation fee to get the NGO permit expedited. And then Karibu expertly managed to get the case officer to tell us each of the 7 different beneficiaries of this money, one of whom being the head of the NGO board, as well as the case officer's target number of facilitation fees for the month from his supervisor. Because this is the definition of systemic corruption, right? Karibu then informed the case officer that due to strict anti-corruption rules, we were actually required to report this bribe, which he just asked us for. And the panic on his face was pretty evident, right? Needless to say, our permit was signed on the spot that day. But after this, we really realized that systemic corruption is not just something that we face, right? It's what our entrepreneurs face all of the time. They have factored in the bribes, the delays, the poor government services as just a cost of doing business. And we knew that it would take real intentionality to give them the courage to stand up against this. So here's my second lesson for you guys. Never, ever take a meeting with a government official in a coffee shop. No, I'm just kidding. The real second lesson here is we must equip local leaders to fight systemic corruption. But this change must first happen from the inside out. So we use this fantastic biblical business ethics model called Holiness, Justice, Love that was created by Alexander Hill. And we combine that with realistic case studies and some pretty lively debate to help our entrepreneurs understand the righteousness that God requires of us, even in the marketplace, and the faith that it takes to trust God, even when doing the right thing costs you everything. And we do see real transformation as a result. In our impact studies, which do allow our entrepreneurs to be anonymous, 72% say that they have refrained from paying bribes in the last year as a direct result of what they learned at Synapis. It's actually not that uncommon for me to hear some of our Synapis alumni complaining about being arrested because they refused to pay a bribe. These are not consequences that most of us face sitting here in the U.S. So it's really easy for us to pass judgment. But if we do not have a strong focus in this area when we are working with local leaders, we're just going to continue to have salt and rot in these environments instead of salt and light. So onward with our story. In late 2010, after receiving our NGO permit, we finally launched our program with our first 7 companies. This guy is one of them that was in our first class, Ernest. So to raise support, we produced our first video. And when I first started showing the video with entrepreneurs like Ernest talking on the screen, people would ask me, "So Courtney, do you give these entrepreneurs like business suits and teach them English so that you can put them on the video?" And I had the hardest time explaining why our entrepreneurs were middle class, highly educated, and yes, actually owned, you know, decent business clothing. "So wait," they would say, "why am I supporting them if they're not poor?" I want to answer that question for you all today by telling you about a man I met when I first moved to Nairobi. His name is Robert. When I first arrived, I rented a house that had a beautiful large garden. But the busyness of founding a new nonprofit soon caught up with me, and I found that my garden was starting to look more like a game park. And as I was leaving my house one day, there was a young man sitting outside of my gate with tattered clothes who said he was looking for work and that he had heard that there was a lady with an untidy garden in this house. No joke. This is like super efficient. Like, forget LinkedIn, guys. This is better. Eventually, this man became my gardener. Robert was from a place called Kitale in Western Kenya, and he was uneducated and married with a very young baby. His wife and child had remained in Western Kenya while Robert had gone to Nairobi in search of work. He had found work impossible to find until that day when I decided to let him cut my grass. But then in 2011, I got married, and my husband and I moved into a smaller house that unfortunately came with a gardener as part of the rent. So this left us with a predicament. What do we do with Robert? We tried finding him a gardener job, but no one else we knew needed one, and he had no other skills, so I decided I am going to help this man start a micro business, right? And I was absolutely sure that I could help him succeed. So first I tried lamps. One day I saw some lamps that were really basic but affordable, something I had found very difficult to find when I was furnishing my new house. So with the seller's permission, I bought 10 lamps as inventory for Robert to sell in other parts of Nairobi. I even had business cards made for him. And I sent him out with the lamps and his cards to sell, and I was feeling pretty darn chuffed with myself for my good deeds. And then about 6 p.m., I received a call from Robert from jail. The city council had picked him up because apparently in Nairobi, you're not allowed to put your inventory on the ground unless you pay a really expensive fee when you're trying to like hawk things. So unfortunately, that was the end of my lamp idea because it's really difficult for Robert to carry around lamps all day. So then I tried computer work. Some expat friends were setting up a business process outsourcing company. So I gave Robert my old computer and I taught him to type and use the internet. But then my friends announced that actually they wouldn't be pursuing a business expansion in Kenya after all. So we were back to square one again. I tried to call Robert with this bad news, but I couldn't reach him. It turns out he had sold a cell phone for $10 to pay for critical medicine for a sick baby. When I found him, he said he was really tired of Nairobi and he wanted to go home and buy some dairy cows and try selling this milk in Kitale. So this time I decided I was going to teach him how to run this business properly, and we even sat down for weeks and we created a business plan together. And my husband and I loaned him $1,000 to purchase his first cows. And at first, things seemed to be going well. Then one night at around 4 a.m., Robert called me from the hospital. Robert's wife was pregnant, but she had been so fearful, sorry guys, that the baby would die of sickness or hunger because they didn't have any money. So she had tried to pull the baby out herself to end the pregnancy. Without a car, Robert wasn't able to get her to the hospital in time to save her or the baby. Sorry, I just have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, and for a woman to do that, that requires a kind of desperation, which I'll probably never understand or know. Then the next few weeks got worse. Robert had never paid his dowry to his wife's parents, so because he had no money, they seized the cows as payment and took his living child. With all my good intentions, it was then that I knew that I had failed him. And I hadn't just failed him, I had failed his wife and his unborn baby. I had completely failed to help this man pull himself out of poverty. And I felt that I had failed in the eyes of God. So why am I telling you this sad story? Because the lessons I learned on this journey with Robert have been very influential in how I think about helping the poor today. The simple fact is that there are not enough jobs in poor countries, so we have to create new companies and new jobs. Foreign companies are not as sustainable as local ones, and so we must develop homegrown entrepreneurs. The very poor, however, are sometimes not able to be successful entrepreneurs themselves. Their life situation, like Robert, is just too fragile to take on the lack of security that goes hand in hand with entrepreneurship. So what follows from this logic is my third lesson. Sometimes helping the poor can mean not working directly with the poor. While it's true that I had failed Robert, I was succeeding in helping others like him through the work I was doing with Synapis. Oops, seem to be skipping. There we go. New businesses were being created out of our program. Almost 60% of our participants that start with no business have actually created a business within 1 year. And these businesses were creating jobs. In fact, the businesses are creating about 2 to 3 jobs on average per year in business. And these businesses are growing. On average, they're growing their revenues by over 100% in the year following the program. And the businesses are surviving. Well over 60% survive 3 years or more, significantly higher than the average startup survival rate. So when I first started to see businesses start to grow and employ more people out of our program, I saw Robert's face in each one. Except unlike Robert, they were earning an income, they were feeding their families, and they were sending kids to school. Today, Synapis entrepreneurs have created over 2,000 new jobs that are supporting roughly 11,000 people economically. And every time I see that number grow, I feel that I'm helping one more Robert. So let's get back to our story. In the first few years of starting Synapis, Kribi and I worked with Acton School of Business to create super rigorous curriculum. We thought we had it nailed. But then came the real world, and we saw the inadequacy of focusing on brilliant business training alone. In 2012, we took a new set of 15 new companies as our second cohort. And this is when I met Daniel Mora, an architect in Nairobi who became fed up with the extreme inefficiencies in construction. So he developed an interlocking concrete block that would act like a giant Lego block. and allow people to build decent housing much faster and cheaper. Daniel was an ideas guy, so he brought in Naomi as his co-founder. And thanks to Daniel's brilliant ideas and Naomi's ruthless execution, BuildMart became one of the leading companies in our accelerator. We helped BuildMart finalize their pitch and raise $85,000 in angel investing to help them buy a machine and set up their first factory. We were super excited about their potential. Then a few weeks later, Daniel showed up with Naomi and his wife in my office. And let me tell you, both ladies looked pretty darn irritated. So the core issue was that Daniel's wife would not sign the paperwork transferring 10% of the shares of BuildMart to Naomi, which was the agreement that Daniel had made with Naomi when she came on board. And what probably could have been mistaken as like a marital counseling session, for the next hour, I tried to understand what was the root cause of the fear. Well, it turns out that the root cause is a really common fear that many Kenyans have about giving up ownership. Anyone can understand why giving up ownership would be a sensitive issue for those who not so long ago have been subjected to colonialism where their rights were largely stripped. So when it came to letting others in, not just Naomi, but this new investor group, Daniel's wife was fearful to the point of even wanting to close the business rather than let others in that could add tremendous value. I managed to sway her mindset from one of a small pie that never grows to a pie which has the potential to be much larger, even if it's not 100% their own. But as we experienced these types of challenges with mindsets, we started to recognize how important it was to not only teach business, but to address the underlying mindsets that were preventing entrepreneurs from realizing their full potential. So this leads me to my fourth lesson. Business training is easy, but mindset shifts are hard. And it's the mindset shifts in combination with the business training that really makes the difference. So how do we address these mindsets in the program? Just like Jesus did. On a whiteboard? No, through story, right? Our stories are a set of case studies which we developed about a husband and wife team that starts a milk processing business named Joseph and Mary. Which is actually based off of one of the businesses that went through our program in 2011. And as the entrepreneurs go through the program, they watch Joseph and Mary, skipping again. They watch Joseph and Mary transform from short-term hustlers doing a copycat venture to being long-term strategic visionaries with an innovative business model, operating with excellence, standing up to corruption, inspiring and developing their employees, and giving their company to God with humility and obedience. The beautiful thing is that we often don't have to tell the entrepreneurs which mindsets they need to change. They speak the words back to us as they read the story. Of course, the biggest mindset change that we hope to achieve with our entrepreneurs is how they view their faith in terms of their business. In the beginning of the program, most entrepreneurs have no idea what their faith has to do with their business. We were so fortunate to be given this fantastic Kingdom Business Framework from Gateway Church in Austin. As the entrepreneurs go through the course, they deep dive into each part of this framework, and they also watch Joseph and Mary wrestle with it through the cases. The good news is that as we see our entrepreneurs experience their faith in a totally different way, because now it's something that they can engage with every day of the week, not just on Sunday. In fact, 76% of our entrepreneurs, of our alumni, say that their faith was significantly strengthened, and 73% say that they completely changed their mindset as to how their faith relates to their business. And while this internal transformation is really fantastic, after the first few years, we started realizing that without action, it doesn't produce much results. So this leads me to our fifth lesson. A spiritual integration plan is as important as a business plan. We started having each entrepreneur also write a detailed spiritual integration plan and commit to putting their faith in action. And what's even more exciting is that 76% of our alumni today, even those going all the way back to 2011, report that they are still actively following a spiritual integration plan for their business. If you're around this afternoon and you own a business or manage a business and you want to deep dive with us into a super practical kingdom business framework and actually create a spiritual integration plan that you can start implementing with your business today, please come to our breakout session. It's at 2:40. We'd love for you to join us. But for some people, the key issue that they have when I talk about how to integrate faith and business is around where we're operating to begin with. But Kenya's already Christian, they would say. Why are you operating there? There's better evangelism opportunities elsewhere. And what I always tell them is while the missionaries in Kenya have done a great job of telling people who Jesus is, Kenya is still one of the most reached and simultaneously unreached places I've ever been. It's still a frontier for missions, just one for discipleship and not conversions. And I always tell people that in addition, my opinion is the greatest frontier left in missions is the marketplace. The marketplace exists in every country around the world, and it is highly influential. So in general, I wish more churches would recognize that one of the places we need missionaries the most is in the boardroom. To prove this point, our impact data actually shows that 22% of our alumni, sorry guys, a bit difficult. 22% of our alumni reported that at least one person came to know Jesus as a result of their efforts as kingdom entrepreneurs. With 1,000 alumni, you guys can start to see what kind of numbers we're talking about. So it just goes to show that if you want to do missions effectively, the marketplace is a fantastic place to start. So onward with our story. After the first few years, I felt that we had really come a long way with our program, but we'd only accelerated 22 companies. And while I was proud of that, I also wanted to reach exponentially more. So I started to recognize that job growth comes from two sources. Frank, who's with us today, I'm not sure if he's in the audience, is a macadamia nut processor and exporter. His business is called 10 Senses Africa. Frank went through our program in 2013, and through a combination of learning really key business principles that helped him unlock operational bottlenecks, as well as being a naturally gifted businessman, Frank grew by 10x in only a few years and now provides income for thousands of smallholder farmers. Then there's Sharon. Sharon is the owner of a lovely photography business. And within a little over a year after the program, she doubled her revenues and tripled her employees. Who has the bigger impact? Well, most of you would probably say Frank. But Frank is actually pretty rare. And there are many more Sharons making a tremendous amount of impact altogether. I wanted to meet the needs of both groups, so in 2013, I decided to take our business training and faith-based training and scale it to as many people as possible, even the Sharons. Then we took the consulting, mentorship, and access to capital, the parts of our model that are actually really hard to scale. And we created what we call now our Fast Track Fellows program and reserved that only for the highest performers. As a result, in 2013, we went from 15 companies in 2012 to 120 companies. That separation of services helped us reach many more businesses while still keeping our Fast Track Fellows program small to provide customized support for entrepreneurs like Frank. And last year alone, we accelerated 344 businesses across 4 countries. So the main lesson here is that we must figure out how to empower the 1,000 as well as the 1 in 1,000 with different, though at times overlapping, support. And when we first started having this separate Fast Track Fellows program, there was a question as to whether we would continue to invest in entrepreneurs directly or whether we would move to an investor matchmaking model. And it really boiled down to one thing. Is the primary barrier to growth capability or is it capital? The answer was beyond a doubt capability. If you asked an investor what their primary problem was, you always got the same answer. There isn't enough deal flow that is ready to accept capital now. Most of the entrepreneurs were showing up with inadequate financials or poorly written business plans. So it wasn't actually that there wasn't enough investment capital available. It was that there weren't enough entrepreneurs ready to receive it. So we focused all of our efforts on capability, and it's really paid off. To date, without Synapis investing anything beyond 2012, our entrepreneurs have raised about $23 million in investment capital from local sources. In fact, our impact data shows that our entrepreneurs raise over 200% more investment capital in the year after our program than in all the years before our program. So this leads to our eighth lesson. Capability unlocks capital, but capital doesn't always unlock capability. So now we're coming to this end of the story. With over 1,000 alumni today, you can imagine that my interaction with our entrepreneurs is quite different than it was with our seven entrepreneurs at the beginning. Having this number of alumni presents incredible opportunities, but it also comes with some challenges. Namely, how do we continue to support these businesses as they grow, while also continuing to focus on our own growth? Sorry, missed that one. Oops. Well, let me just move ahead to this one. As an example, you remember my story about BuildMart, right? So after getting his factory and experiencing some significant initial trials, Daniel finally got his big break. He got a $6 million government contract to build all of the police housing units in Nairobi. His angel investors were super excited. Well, we gave that loan in 2012 as a three-year loan. It is now late 2018, almost 7 years later, and we are still waiting. Years of delayed payments and false promises from the government about this contract have meant that Daniel is only just now completing the work. So here's our ninth lesson. It took 7 days to bring down the wall of Jericho, but 7 years and counting to support one business. So we must remember that the length of our program is just not going to be long enough to support entrepreneurs through the many challenges they're going to have ahead. Does that mean that our programs need to be 7 years long? Not necessarily, but it does mean that we need to figure out how to support entrepreneurs even after they leave the nest. Sometimes this can be through our own alumni programming, and sometimes it can be with partnering other organizations that are already working downstream. Because we all know that many hands make light work, right? So a little over a year ago, after having my second child, I transitioned from executive director to being on the board. And I was extremely lucky to find two amazing leaders that are here today, Matthew and Toby. Can you guys raise your hand and wave? Yeah, there they are, right here and here, to pass the baton to. And when I transitioned, many people asked me how I wanted to see us achieve this vision of accelerating 10,000 kingdom entrepreneurs globally. And my answer for that is simple. A movement is better than an empire. And that's my final lesson. And there's no one who's really demonstrated this better than this BAM group. Mats and Joe and Jason and Mark have demonstrated this so proficiently for us. With so little, they've done so much to serve this BAM movement that God is directing. In the same way, my vision for Synapis is that we would help to catalyze a movement of faith-based accelerators that want to support kingdom entrepreneurs worldwide. So to prove it, here's an opportunity for you to join us. Oops, this opportunity is slippery. Okay, so after getting requests for years to license our curriculum, we have finally designed a program just for that purpose, and we are looking for individuals or organizations that want to start or grow a faith-based accelerator to empower God-glorifying enterprises around the world. We're looking for those that have a heart for our mission, have the deep business skills required to effectively train entrepreneurs with the curriculum, have intimate knowledge of the region where they want to launch, have the ability to raise the funding to get the program started and to sustain it, and are committing to a longer-term presence, not just like a fly-in approach. And instead of just people that want to just copy our program, we also want people that are fellow creators, people that will create new value and then in return share that knowledge with us and others. We're going to give the selected groups access to all 40 modules of our curriculum, which was created with blood, sweat, and tears. Toolkits where we'll provide step-by-step guidance on how to do all parts of our program, and a community of like-minded people that want to share resources, knowledge, and pray for each other so that we can all grow faster together. So we want to invite anyone that is interested to apply to come to our first inaugural partner boot camp in Nairobi. It'll be April 5th to the 11th, where we're going to teach you everything we know and also provide you with an opportunity to form relationships that will be the foundation of a brand new BAM Accelerator network. If you're interested, and even if you can't make these dates, please come talk to Matthew or Toby or myself afterwards. So I'm just going to end this talk by saying that even if you have no interest in entrepreneurs or accelerators, I really hope that you will take the opportunity this weekend to find out what your role is in this greater BAM movement. I remember reading a fantastic quote. I can't actually remember the author, but I think there's a very good chance it might be someone in this room. And he said, "If Satan is winning the battle for the marketplace, it is because we, Christian business people, are sitting on the sidelines and watching." So my question to you is, are you going to continue to sit on the sidelines, or are you going to join us today? Thank you very much.